consider it an honor to be able to introduce our speaker tonight because he's a man that I respect very, very highly and hold in great esteem. In 2005, an article in a local paper described Mitchell Bird this way. Bird is the man who many say has saved the bald eagle. They also say he is the man who brought the peregrine falcon back to life east of the Mississippi River. At William & Mary, they say that the nationally recognized biology program that's housed there truly took shape during the 13 years that Bird chaired the department. In 1991, as he retired as Chancellor Professor of Biology at William & Mary, Bird and one of his other former students, Brian Watts, co-founded the Center for Conservation Biology in order to provide an opportunity to continue to do endangered species research. Dr. Bird is widely published in many journals and publications. Some of them are Water Birds, Condor, the Journal of Wildlife Management, The Raven, and the Center for Conservation Biology Technical Report Series. He is known for, has received many honors, and several of those that I'll mention. In 2007, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service awarded him the Recovery Champions Award for his work with bald eagles and peregrine falcons. One of my favorite birds, as you all know, is the osprey, and Mitchell Bird has tagged over 3,500 osprey. In 2008, Dr. Bird, and I just got to meet his lovely wife, Lois, tonight, were awarded Friends of the College at Virginia Tech Award. And then also another aspect that we all are very, very pleased with is that Dr. Bird and one of his colleagues in 1977 were instrumental in founding the Williamsburg Bird Club. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mitchell Bird.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. It's really nice to see so many people here, and particularly some people that I haven't seen for quite a long time. I also noticed that a number of my former graduate students are here, so I suppose I'll have to be fairly honest. One of the questions, well, first of all, I think there are a lot of people here who are birders and there are some who are not. But no matter whether you are or not, I think you've probably noticed over time that there are fluctuations in bird populations. Sometimes they're seasonal, sometimes they're annual, sometimes they're permanent, unfortunately. But whether you're a birder or not, it doesn't matter. These things are happening. One of the questions people often ask me is, how did you ever get interested in birds back in the 30s and 40s when it wasn't a particular popular pastime? Is it because of your name? No, it isn't. They spell one of the feathers incorrectly all the time. If you give me a little bit of time, though, I will go back and explain to you how that happened, because it was sort of an evolutionary process, not in the sense of biological evolution, but in terms of sequence of events. I grew up in Franklin, not Franklin County of moonshine fame, but Southampton County across the river. I don't think that was immune to that great old American tradition either. Nevertheless, I wasn't there. Franklin was a small town, and nobody in that town had ever heard of watching birds. Mostly in the 30s and 40s, they were more interested in staying alive. But I think I, like most kids, had a curiosity about the natural world. I know Bill Williams did, and I'll say a couple of things later about Bill Williams. But having that natural curiosity, I went out in the woods a lot and wandered around and began to notice birds, but I didn't have any of the tools that kids have these days. And I mean simple things like binoculars and field guides and those things. So it's sort of winging it, so to speak. Somewhere along the line, my father found me an old abandoned pair of binoculars. I think they were discarded Navy things. They weighed about 10 pounds. I wouldn't be caught dead in the field with them now. But they worked. I could see things. And I began to get a little bit of proficiency in that. And I had a friend in high school whose father was an engineer with the Navy. And Wallops Naval Air Station was under his jurisdiction. And he would periodically go up there on weekends and have inspection trips. He would take us along. Here we were the 14-year-old kids. And he'd drop us off on the banks of Chincoteague. Chincoteague was just a little fishing village at that time. But the thing that I most remember about it was the incredible number of waterfowl. I remember you could look up at most any point and the sky would be black with brown. In fact, there were so many waterfowl, the bag limit at that time was 15 a day. But five of them had to be made up of black ducks, which we're now concerned about as a species. Well, that really got me hooked. And finally, I went off to Virginia Tech and met a kindred spirit there. And the thing that I remember most about birding around Virginia Tech was on a spring morning, we would go up to the president's house. I don't know that he ever wondered why we were peeping around his house with binoculars at 6 in the morning. But if it happened to be a flight night, it would literally be raining warblers the next morning and other things. But it would not be difficult in the morning to see maybe 15 species of warblers in the morning birding there. I have not seen dropouts like that since very much. Occasionally we'd have the Kiptopeka in the early days, but not more recently. Well, I finally ended up going back to Virginia Tech for graduate work for reasons I won't go into. But the first person I met there was a young man named Sandy Sprunt. Well, if any of you are familiar with the ornithological literature, you know that there was a book, Birds of South Carolina, written by Alexander Sprunt Jr. Well, that was Sandy Sprunt's father. He was number four. I don't know whatever happened to number three. But Sandy was a very accomplished birder. He later became research director for National Audubon Society. But when I finally got out of school, I thought, well, I can finally get out, find an academic job, and start working with birds. The United States Army had other plans. 2 weeks after I graduated, I was in the Army, and they didn't know exactly what to do with me. So they put me in a biological warfare laboratory, which wasn't my thing at all. And after I finally got security clearance, I had this colonel call me in and say, we have a job for you, Bird. I thought, what? Colonel tells you something you got a job to do and get busy and start thinking about it. He said, I want you to learn how to raise a large number of oriental rat fleas in an artificial medium. I thought, fleas? I don't know anything about fleas. I knew they hop, I knew dogs had them. But other than that, I didn't know much about them. But I finally did figure this out, a medium of dried blood and yeast and so on. And I finally left the Army with some of the happiest fleas in North America. Well, academic jobs weren't very easy to get at that time. They just weren't in 1956. I traveled all over the country. Finally, one day, I happened to be driving through Williamsburg, and I stopped and asked if they possibly had an opening. They just had a resignation. It was too late for them to find anybody else. They said, well, we'll give you a job for 1 year. Turned out to be 50. So it worked out pretty well. Well, I finally had this opportunity to start working with birds. And the first project of study that I did was with wild turkeys. And there was a reason for that. Back in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and probably well into the 70s, most states had game farms. And they were raising birds of different species, ringneck pheasants, and so, et cetera. And ostensibly, this was the purpose of this was to establish populations in the wild. It never worked very well. I never thought it was a very valuable management technique. but all the states were trying it. And Virginia was no exception. But in Virginia, they were raising quail and wild turkeys. And the game farm was in the middle of the Cumberland State Forest. Well, I got a call from the Game Commission saying that we have a potential problem. Would you mind working on this? And I think they picked me not because I knew anything about the particular problem, but because I was very familiar with the area. I'd done all the field work for my doctoral dissertation in that area. But the problem had to do with a parasitic disease. It was called leucocytosome. I'm sure you all know about leucocytosome. I didn't know anything about it either. It's a protozoan, and there are about 100 species of it. They occur in about 100 species of birds. And usually they are subclinical infections. They don't cause mortality. But occasionally a couple of species do cause mortality. Well, at the game farm in Virginia, they were raising turkeys, and they were doing it in a fairly innovative way. They had these big pens out in the forest. They put these pinion captive reared hens in there and let the wild gobblers fly over and mate with them. Well, they were having trouble with horned owls coming in at night and decapitating some of these hens, which wasn't a good thing. And they finally started building coops at the ends of these big enclosures, and they run the turkeys in there at night until they were protected. Well, after a couple of weeks, these old gobblers got so used to it, you could run them right in a coop at night with these captive reared hens. They obviously knew a good thing when they saw it. Well, I wanted to expose turkeys to see if they had this disease or could get it. And there was no way to know whether we even had... This is a disease that's transmitted by black flies. If you've ever been up north and seen no-see-ums, they are black flies. This is a different species. First step is to see where they occurred, if they did. And they were occurring there. They were coming out of the Willis River, which was some 2 miles away probably from a game farm. And all the sampling I did, I never found the flies around the game farm. But I was still curious as to whether it was in the wild population. So I wanted to expose young poults out in these pens in early March, late March and early April, when the flies were emerging. Well, it was very difficult to do that because there weren't any turkeys being hatched at the game farm. So what I ended up doing was getting young wild turkeys from a domestic turkey raiser. And I wanted to put them out in these pens at night and leave them all the time so that they would be subject to biting by these flies. Couldn't do that. It was too cold. So when did I get these hens to brood them? They aren't broody. So I thought, well, what causes turkeys to be broody, or any other birds for that matter? It's a pituitary hormone, prolactin. So I thought, well, why don't I just inject these old gals with a bunch of prolactin and see what happens? Boy, did it work. Not only did they take these broods and brood them successfully, but I had a couple of hens that didn't have broods. When I go in the pen, they come running over and brood my feet. Now, if you've never been brooded by a wild turkey, you just had one of life's great adventures. Well, the gist of the story of the thing was that we did get some transmission to these little chicks in the wild. It was subclinical. It did not bother them. Obviously, the wild turkey population, the wild ones, had it. So it was not a problem for the game farm. I'm sure they were pleased with that. Then we came along in the 70s with the ideas of releasing all sorts of exotic game birds in North America. And Virginia was no exception. There was an official Wildlife Service biologist who'd gone all over the world looking at different ecological conditions and trying to figure out where in the United States we had similar conditions. A little difficult task. Well, they released some agates, pheasants in Ohio. That's a bird indigenous to the mountains of China. I'm not sure where the comparable mountains are in Ohio. But in Virginia, they released a lot of ringneck pheasants out on Sandy Point here on the Chickahominy River. They thrived for a while. One of my first graduate students studied that population, but then they eventually disappeared. Pheasants have never been successfully started south of the Mason-Dixon line. I don't know why. Maybe they're a northern race or something. anyway, they haven't been successful there. Then they tried Japanese green pheasants on the eastern shore. They thrived for a while. I used to see broods over there occasionally, but then they disappeared. So none of these things were really working. And what really worked with wild turkeys was trapping birds from the indigenous population and transplanting them. And that has been an amazing success. I think shown very readily by the fact that in the 1916 season, there were over 20,000 wild turkeys harvested in the turkey season. And there's still a lot of turkeys out there. Well, after that, I sort of got interested in the Barrier Islands. I'd read a lot about the Barrier Islands. Nobody knew too much about them, what was on them. And so I decided to start going out there and do surveys of the colonial birds out there. I was not interested in doing particular research with them. I was interested in developing a baseline of populations. Incidentally, I want to go back and mention this one thing I forgot with respect to the turkey farm. One day, I took this little kid from Williamsburg up there with me. He enjoyed watching me rip the livers out of these turkeys. I won't mention any names, but he's president of the bird club. Anyway, we started doing, can you imagine, Bill Weaver's a little kid, you know I'm getting old. We finally got about 4 years data on the colonies of birds on the Barrier Islands. And I wrote a report on each island and documented what was there and so on. And I sent it up to the Nature Conservancy. I said, this is a great place. You really ought to have a project here. And I got a response back and sorry, but we don't have any money to do that. Well, about a year or two passed, and all of a sudden, a dummy corporation bought Cobb Island. It was a dummy corporation because the locals did not want the Nature Conservancy or any other conservation organization buying their islands. Well, this proceeded, and finally the Conservancy acquired virtually all of the islands over there. I don't know whether my report had any impact on it or not. I'd like to think that it did, but it doesn't matter. The fact is that every island over there now is either in Conservancy protection or federal or state protection. And this is a real, real conservation achievement, in my opinion. Sometimes we run into some difficulties out there. For example, on Hawk Island, which one time had a regular town on it called Broadwater, which is now out at sea. There was a local there that had a herd of cattle he ran on Hog Island. His name was Barefoot Bowen. It doesn't take much imagination to know where I got the name. Barefoot was never known to wear shoes, summer or winter. But amongst his herd of cattle was a big bull named Beauregard. And I never found that Beauregard was particularly favorably inclined to people walking on the beach there. So when Beauregard was out throwing surf 10 feet behind him, we just sort of bypassed Beauregard on those particular days. Well, those surveys have been continued, were continued for many years after that by Bill Williams and Ruth Beck and Bill Akers and Jerry Vire. Now the Fish and Wildlife Service and Nature Conservancy have taken them over. One of the things I noticed when I was out there a lot, particularly on an island called Knockhorn Island, there were about 20 to 25 osprey nests when I first started going out there. That number declined radically while I was working out there. And not only did it decline, the birds weren't producing any offspring. And I finally got back and started fiddling around Williamsburg looking at nests, realized none of them were producing offspring either. So I decided that maybe I'd start a 20-year project on ospreys. Well, the first step was to see what we had. So we took a boat, did surveys on the Potomac River and all the way down to the James River, did that periodically 3 or 4 times per summer, and monitored and documented all the nests that were on those rivers. Turned out that we had about 400 breeding pairs at that time. We don't know what the original population was, but certainly it was substantially more than 400 breeding pairs. Well, we began to check these nests and found out that most of them were not hatching out eggs. So one of the first steps was to collect eggs, which we did, and Jerry Vio, who was a graduate student, had analyzed these eggs. We were getting incredible levels of DDT in them, which is a metabolite of DDT. So that was clearly the problem. Well, what do you do about it? Well, we couldn't do anything, but finally DDT was banned in 1973 from use in this country. One of the first things that happened after that was the population began to expand, to grow, and expand its range. One of the places that it grew very radically was in Lapjack Bay. And the reproductive success went up very greatly there. And after about 10 or 15 years, I had a student that did a food habit study there. And the food that was predominantly favored by birds there was menhaden. After about 15 years, I noticed the production was declining again. And I wondered why. And so we had another student do a food habit study there and found out that rather than about 90% of the diet being menhaden, it dropped down to about 10%. Well, ospreys clearly can get alternative prey, but it's not this rich food that menhaden is. I'll come back to that. That seemed to be the basic problem with that. Well, not only did we do food habit studies, but I banded about 2,500 ospreys on a color banded them. And at one point, we had about 200 pairs color banded with numbers on the bands so that we could identify each of those birds individually. So I knew who was paired off with whom on about 200 different nests. That gave us the opportunity to study mate fidelity, study site fidelity. We found out that for site fidelity, these birds were incredibly faithful. If they didn't come back in a subsequent year, you could be pretty sure that they passed away somewhere during the winter time. Mate fidelity was extremely high. I only had one case of a divorce. I had one case where I had a 10-year-old male paired off with a 9-year-old female. The next year they came back, he was paired off with a 5-year-old female. And she had moved out on the bay with another male that was not banded. My conclusion was that 10 years was the midlife crisis time in the male hospital. Now, we found that when they came back to breed for the first time, the females dispersed much further than the males, probably because they do learn foraging behavior before they leave the first time. So it's valuable for those males to know where to forage, because coming back to where they hatched out is probably the best procedure for them. But I will tell you that ospreys are the greatest collectors of junk you ever saw. I found all sorts of things in osprey nests, from crab plot floats to rope. But one of the things we found frequently was birds totally wrapped up in monofilament line. I don't know how many times I had to take scissors and cut them loose. So we had some posters made up, and we put them around marinas and boat ramps with a picture of an osprey warning people about this monofilament line. And it did seem to slack off for a while, but it seemed now it's right back up where it was. So I think it's still an issue. But where is the population going now? Well, even though in Lapjack Bay the reproduction has declined, it's been very well in all areas. And so where we started with 400 nests, I cannot tell you the exact number precisely because we haven't done a complete survey for years. Well, I can tell you that we have over 300 just on the James River. And our estimate is that in the Chesapeake Bay watershed as a whole, we probably have 10,000 breeding pairs of ospreys at this particular time. So that is a remarkable recovery and one of the real success stories. Well, I'll go back to this. We did a lot of colonial bird studies. thanks to Inga, we have a picture of a few. Great egret, great blue heron, another great blue heron. What was that thing?
Tricolor,
yeah. A little blue. Number two, a little blue.
A little blue?
And so on. Well, during Bay County Cattle Egret. Well, that was something that happened during the course of our observations of wading birds. There were some immigrants that moved in, cattle egrets being one of them. The first cattle egret nested just outside of Watcha Creek in 1961. Cattle egrets made their way from Africa to Suriname and eventually to Florida. And then they expanded their range northward and entered Virginia in 1961. And they literally exploded in numbers. At one time we had well over 1,500 pair in Virginia. But all of a sudden they started declining. In one decade, that population dropped 89%. This is true all over the country. Cattle egrets became the most numerically abundant heron in North America at one point. Nobody knows why they started declining like that. Another bird that moved into these colonies that was a newcomer was glossy ibis. There'd been a small breeding population of glossy ibis in Florida down below Lake Okeechobee. They suddenly started moving north, and they literally exploded in Virginia. They started declining, and now they're much, much fewer in numbers than they were. And then finally, one of my graduate students was working on Fishman Island. She was studying nest site selection in cattle egrets because the concern was, are they competing with our native herons or for nesting sites? Well, while there, she discovered the first nesting of white ibis in Virginia in 1977. And they stuck around on Fishman for a while and didn't do much, and I never expected them to. Because in Keith Bilstein's book on the white ibis, he says that they can't feed their young on saltwater prey until they're about 10 or 12 years old. Well, it's not a tremendous amount of salt water, I mean fresh water on the eastern shore. So what are they feeding these young? Obviously something, because the white ibis population over there has literally gone out of sight. It's not uncommon to see 200 or 300 pair of birds at one time. Some of them may be migrants to the south, but there are an awful lot of them breeding there now. Well, the thing about cattle egrets, they were not competing for nest sites. They were nesting on a different stratum in the canopy, so that didn't appear to be an issue. The same thing was true with glossy ibis. We wanted to know whether they were competing for nest sites. Well, we had a new graduate student at William & Mary at that time who came in. I think he was sort of weirdly oriented. He wanted to work with lizards. Somebody at William & Mary convinced him that birds are a much more interesting taxonomic group. So he did this study on glossy ibis. Again, no names. And it was pretty much the same thing. They were nesting in a different stratum of vegetation. Well, about that time, the Endangered Species Act had been passed, and most states were setting up what they call non-game endangered species programs. Most states referred to the species involved as non-consumptive wildlife. It seems like an odd term to apply to 99% of the fauna. I think what they meant, you couldn't eat them legally, but anyway, it sounded to me like they didn't have tuberculosis. Well, there were three species in Virginia that they were concerned about. Red-cockaded woodpeckers, prairie falcons, and bald eagles. So in 1978, they asked me to take over a series of programs involving those three species. Well, if you're familiar with red-cockaded woodpeckers, they have an unusual breeding strategy. Many people here know about it. But they breed in groups, or clusters. And the young of one year stick around to help feed the young the next year. Evolutionarily, that probably in the long run produces more young than they would if they bred as individual pairs. Otherwise, I doubt if that behavior would evolve. But anyway, they drill their cavities in living pine trees, and they have to be anywhere from 80 to 100 years plus in age. Well, that's an issue. You've got a species that's highly dependent on one particular habitat. If that habitat becomes in short supply, obviously they're going to have problems. But we had no idea how many red-cockaded woodpeckers were in Virginia. So I was on sabbatical one year, and so I started down in the Dismal Swamp. I took 7.5-minute topographic maps, and everywhere there was green on it showing forest. If there wasn't green, and it was forest, I plotted it in. And I cannot tell you how many pine woods I walked through looking for red-cockaded woodpeckers. It's pretty obvious because they do this big rosin flow on the trees, and they're very easy to spot in the woods. I also did a lot of playbacks. Well, in the course of that 1 year, I found 28 places in Virginia where red-cockaded woodpeckers occurred, with about 45 clusters. Well, over the next few years, I saw one of those areas logged after another, even though they were on the endangered species list and nobody was prosecuting. I kept reporting it, nothing happened. Mm-hmm. I was even over in the Wakefield Diamond one morning having breakfast, and I saw a logging truck go by with a red-cockaded woodpecker cavity in one of the logs. We finally got down to one place where we had red-cockaded woodpeckers. And you know that many of you is Piney Grove. And there were only about 8-9 birds that were left there. It had grown out of being useful habitat. It had a heavy canopy below the pine trees. It was beginning to grow up to obscure the cavities. And it didn't have long-term prognosis as far as I was concerned. But we kept monitoring it. And we kept having problems. We had pileated woodpeckers enlarging the cavities. And we had other species taking over the cavities. I was over there with one of my graduate students one day and went to a tree that had been an active site the year before, tapped on it, because there were no rosin wells that indicated it wasn't being used. And this flying squirrel came out. Well, I was pretty protective of the woodpecker, so much as I hate to admit it, I disposed of the flying squirrel, a gorgeous little creature. Well, my graduate student climbed up a ladder to the tree, he looked at the cavity and said, "There's a baby flying squirrel in here." Well, then I really, really felt bad. This poor grain, he stuck it in his pocket, took it home with him, and raised it. It lived to the ripe old age of 13, which I think established a new longevity record for flying squirrels. They'd never gotten that kind of lifespan of maternal care, so I didn't feel too bad about that. But anyway, he became quite a pet in the household, and they named him Little Mitchell. Well, Little Mitchell pretty much had the run of the place. And as the story goes, Little Mitchell was one day with sailing from drapery to drapery, and their daughter had his boyfriend had to meet the family. You know how that goes, you know, it's romance. So Little Mitchell sails up and lands on his foot and runs up the boy's pants. As you can imagine, that caused a bit of consternation. And they finally extricated Little Mitchell. And that may be the only record we have of a southern flying squirrel terminating a romance. Well, sometimes later, Mike Lipford, who was director of the Nature Conservancy, approached me. I was on the board and said, "What do you think about us buying Piney Grove?" I said, "Well, if you keep it like it is, you're wasting your money. But if you're going to manage it properly by removing all the hardwoods and do periodic burning to maintain it, go for it." So they did, and it's worked really well. We've got a maximum of 63 birds down there instead of 9. We have brought in a couple groups of birds from South Carolina to augment the population, mainly to enhance the gene pool a little bit. In the last couple of years, we moved some birds to the Dismal Swamp. I think it's terrible habitat. I don't think it has a long-range chance of surviving. But we did have two of those pairs that we moved down to lay eggs this year and bring off too young. So we'll wait to see what happens. The second species, peregrine falcons, was a little more difficult to deal with because we didn't have any. They had been totally extirpated east of the Mississippi River. And so the job we had was how to get them back. Well, we discussed all sorts of alternatives. I was on the peregrine falcon recovery team. And we finally concluded the only reasonable way to do this was to have a captive breeding program and introduce these birds into the wild. That was very controversial. National Audubon kind of objected because the only way we could do it was to use races of the peregrine, which were not indigenous to the area originally. Well, they share 90% of a genetic background, so to me that was not a very viable discussion to have. We finally ended up using just the old anadans, which are characteristic of Virginia, and most of the 48 Peel's falcons from the Queen Charlotte Islands, and some European birds. There are 26 races of peregrine falcons around the world. Those three seem to be the best to use. So they established a captive breeding program at Cornell, and they provided the birds for us. They were released very much the way that falconers do, which is called hacking. You put them in a box, feed them so that they don't associate you with the management, with any appropriation of food. And then at a certain time, you release them, let them start flying. They continue to come back for food until they're independent, and then they disperse. That's a very successful way of getting them into the wild. We've done a lot of them in the mountains. We've done a lot of them on the coast. We built a whole series of towers on the Barry Islands. There are birds on all of them now. And so as of this spring, we have 31 nesting pairs in tidewater. We have not had good luck in the mountains for a reason I really don't understand. And it's possible there are more there than we know about. They're just much more difficult to find. But I had a couple of very interesting events with falcons. Some of them fell in Yermas. In one case, we had a pair of falcons nesting in the crow's nest of one of the multiple ships. And it was about 30 feet up, and it was a little narrow ladder there that I had no great desire to climb, but I did. And I noticed one day that the falcons, I was like hanging on this thing, this female falcon trying to remove my cranium from the rest of my body. And these little falcon chicks are screaming murder. And I noticed in their throat they had this white mess. And I knew immediately what it was. I'd heard falconers talk about it. It's caused by a flagellate that they get from feeding on pigeons. It's called, the falconers call it thrush. So I came back and called one of my former students, Dave Bawley, who was a veterinarian here in town. I said, what do I do about this? He said, feed them flagellate, they'll take care of it. Well, flagellate is also used to treat it condition in humans, which I won't go into. He said, I'm going to write this prescription for you, but I'm not going to put your name on it because it isn't for you, but he said, the pharmacist will know what to do about it, and he can call me if you have a question. So I took it in. It wasn't a he pharmacist, it was a she pharmacist. And she looked at this prescription and said, who is this Dr. Bawley? I said, he's a veterinarian in town. And she said, he can't write you a prescription for this. I said, it's not for me. It's for a peregrine falcon. She said, are you Mr. Falcon? I said, no. A peregrine falcon's a bird. She said, what's your name? I said, Bird. Who's on first? Well, it ended up, they finally put my name on the prescription, and she talked to pharmacist and said to get treated the falcons, and they got over the problem. So there are lots of interesting things going on. Well, you know, we did bald eagles, right? Because I'm going to quickly end here. No. I started 78 flying bald eagle surveys. I've done it 41 years in a row now. And when we started, there were 32 nesting pairs in Virginia. On the James River, for a number of years, about 5 years, there were absolutely no breeding birds on the James River. It got pretty frustrating not finding anything. And then finally, a pair occupied the river for the first time in several years, and they actually nested in a tree that had an active nest center in the 1960s. Big, massive pine tree on Brandon Plantation. Well, after that, the population, after DDT was banned, slowly began to grow. And actually, by 1980, there were 18 pairs there. By 2057, and this past year, we had 272 nested pairs on the James River. But we noticed some interesting things on the James. Population biologists are always wondering, what is it that causes a population to grow to a certain size and stop? And Brian and I thought, well, here on the James, we've got a perfect example to follow it. We've got a situation where there are no birds, where the population is starting to grow, we can follow it through until it reaches maximum density. One thing we noticed, even starting in the 1990s, the production of eagles, which had been superb, was beginning to decline a little bit each year. And we also found, we always question this when we get through with the flight, why aren't there more nests given the number of young that we're seeing produced? And what was happening is that they were producing more young, they were maturing to adults, and they were exceeding the capacity of creating new territories. So what we have there now is a group of non-breeding eagles mixed in with this population of breeding eagles. In a sense, a group of haves and have-nots. I think I've heard that term a lot recently. So these non-breeding eagles are harassing the breeding ones. And what we think we might have there is a sort of a negative behavioral feedback mechanism that is causing the reproduction to drop and might eventually be the factor that will stabilize that population on the James. Well, we ran into a lot of different conservation issues on the Eagle Project. I don't have time to go into all of them. I'll mention just one or two. Nobody told me how long I could talk. One of the things we came up with really early was, where do we have the best concentration of eagles? And I was advised of a place on the Potomac. We have a large number of eagles roosting on it. This is a time when we had very, very few eagles that we knew about. So I went up there, and it was true, but I counted 26 roosting on one little pond there. And it was a property that had been given to the state for development as a state park. Well, I thought there was a higher use for it. And I got nowhere talking to the Division of Parks. I understand that. That's not their function. I tried talking to any number of people in the state government. That didn't work. Well, I finally decided there was more than one way to remove the integument from a feline. So I heard that the governor's wife was interested in eagles. So, well, I'll just write the governor's wife. What have I got to lose? So I did, expected to hear nothing. And about a week later, I got a call from the governor's office. They were setting up a task force to come up with a plan for this project. Would you be on the task force? Oh, yeah, I'll be on the task force. And we had Vice President of National Audubon, the Vice President of National Wildlife Federation, Official Wildlife Service employee. And what we came up with was a plan for Caledon made it a state natural area with very limited access, but some access, but mainly for the purposes that you would expect a natural area to have. We had a similar area on the James River. I was called by a forester one day and worked for Continental Can Company. She told me that they were getting ready to sell this property, but there are a lot of eagles there. I said, well, are they white heads and white tails? She said, oh, no, they're all dark. I thought, oh, man, turkey vultures are roost. Well, I went up there the next morning. I counted 26 eagles come out of one tree there. When I started doing surveys on the Rubberland, it was not at all unusual then, and eagles were just beginning to recover, to see 150 or 200 eagles along the river. And I think this is an important area. I think roost areas may be important to nest areas. They have a longer history of longevity. Eagle nests are sort of ephemeral. They change a lot over the years. Roost areas don't. I've never been able to convince the Fish and Wildlife Service they ought to be protecting roost areas as much or more than the nest area. But I began to take people out up there, trying to convince them we ought to do something about this. Same thing, I wasn't getting anywhere. Well, I remember the governor's wife, and I'd taken the Secretary of Natural Resources, I'd taken the head of the Senate Finance Committee, I'd taken all sorts of people up there, no luck. I knew that the governor's wife was on the Board of Environmental Endowment, so I made an inquiry to see if she was interested in coming up and looking at eagles. Well, she was very delighted to come. She came with two big state troopers, I might add. And one of them told me when they said, be at the governor's mansion to go bird watching at 5 o'clock, I thought they were insane. Well, we went out and saw about 150 eagles. And she was very impressed. I said, well, can I talk to you about this area? She said, well, I've really got to get back to the real world. I said, you've just been in it. You've been back to a false one. And she said, well, I agree with you. It's running my life. Anyway, that's another story. Well, about a week later, I got a call from the new director of the Nature Conservancy, the same Michael Lipford that I talked to about Piney Grove later. He went out with me, and I was saying 2 weeks the Nature Conservancy bought that property. The biggest acquisition for Nashville they'd ever made at that point. So now it's the Chamber of a National Wildlife Refuge, and it's a really, really neat area. One final thing, and I will shut up. I'd like to mention something about birding and conservation. I think if you ask any biologist why it's important to conserve birds, I could give you a number of answers. Their role in the ecosystem, their indicators of environmental contaminants, any number of things. I think many birders could do the same thing. But I think when you look at the population as a whole, there's a disjunct there between the general population and their relationship to the natural world. And I think they do not realize how incredibly sensitive and how much is going on with respect to bird populations all over the world. Probably 70% of the boreal forest birds are in danger. I think the shorebird people think that probably all of the shorebirds are declining. We're on the verge, I think, of environmental catastrophe if we don't do something about this. And yet, I see every year birds and other species coming up for listing under the Endangered Species Act, despite the fact we have an Endangered Species Act. And I think what many people would consider an exemplary system of refuges, parks, and things, the envy of the world. So what are we doing wrong? I think there are a couple of things we have done wrong, and there are many things that impact on birds. But one thing we have done wrong, particularly under the Endangered Species Act, is that we focus too much on the species. We spent millions on bald eagles and California condors. But how much money have you heard spent on the Furbish lacework, an endangered plant? Not a dime. A lot of species have gotten no attention because we're putting too much attention on high-profile species. I think that called attention to the Endangered Species Act in the beginning, but I think it's time we took a different approach and started thinking about systems rather than individual species. I think that's one approach we have to take. And the other thing is, I think we've managed our land improperly. When you look at our refuges and protected areas, many of them have no specific ecological boundaries, and more importantly, none of them were really designed in the beginning to promote high levels of biodiversity. I think that we have to change that approach. As I pointed out at the Nature Conservancy annual meeting one year, We need to think in terms of protecting big, big pieces of land, not little pieces of land. I think in years past, it may have been important to buy a 30-acre tract to protect a particular orchid, maybe. But in terms of protecting biodiversity, you need big pieces of land. And given the economics of land and things of that sort, it's probably going to be impossible to put together huge blocks of land and buy them at one point. So maybe what we have to do is take a lot of existing lands and tie them together as best we can. And that may not be all that difficult, really. It'll take an unprecedented level of cooperation in the management agencies. Often it's said that the problem with fragmentation of habitat has been accustomed by a fragmentation of agencies dealing with habitats. Mm-hmm. You have so many people dealing with different pieces of land. They all have different objectives. They all look at land management from a different perspective. I once suggested that maybe what we did in Virginia was an omnipotent environmental czar who would have complete authority over all lands in Virginia. I didn't get very far with that. But anyway, that's what the approach should be, and I can give you some examples of how it would work. Up on the Rappahannock River, there's an 80,000 military base, AP Hill, although it probably changed the name of it at some point.
Yeah.
Right next to it is a Pettigrew Management Area belongs to the Game Commission. They abut each other. There's a big marsh down next to that, and there's an eastern arm, and across the river, there's another huge marsh. So there you have probably 90,000 acres in one continuum. What we need is a constant management plan for that property and for all properties like it. I think if we don't, we're going to push towards a level of biological impoverishment in this country and this world, which is either biologically or morally acceptable. Birds can play a role in this. People say, well, what can I do? Well, I think for one thing, if you know of any conservation projects, you involve yourself in it. Right now, one thing you can do is let your representatives know what you think about different environmental objectives. We have a congressman that represents us now that's voted negatively on 95% of every environmental issue that's come up. We have a congressman, Newport News, who's voted positively 95%. On everything that's come up. Let your voice be heard. Well, my little voice doesn't matter if they know, but 10,000 of your voices do matter. And I think if we don't take those steps, birding is great fun. I often hear statements, well, we don't have any pristine areas left to protect. Conservation is not about protecting pristine, it's about protecting biodiversity. And just because an area pristine isn't pristine doesn't mean that it's not important for protection. So I hope it will be able to allow us as birders to involve ourselves a lot more in conservation issues. Because I think if we don't, maybe 25 years from now, we won't be practicing conservation biology. We'll be practicing restoration ecology. So with that, I will stop. And if you want to ask some questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them.